For the week of April 8th, 2012, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 144, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And at the Bastille in France, I'm Michael Gills.
Okay, now why are you at the Bastille in France? Do I even want to know?
Well, apparently I used a phrase in French a few weeks ago. I don't remember the context, but my pronunciation was horrific and incroyable, if you want. And my mother was aghast and embarrassed and ashamed and corrected me. Apparently, it's one of those phrases you only read, you know, something you've read but never actually heard. And I said it like I was Ma and Pa Kettle. I said it was fin du sickle. And apparently it's fin du sickle.
You know, I remember, you said that here on the show. It wasn't like you were saying that out in life.
Right, yeah, that's why I bring it up.
Yeah, and I do remember you saying that, and I remember thinking, did he just...
That's not right.
Did he just sneeze? Because I don't think he said that right.
And my mother was aghast, and my brother said I was a pretentious twit for using the phrase in the first place, so here I am, in the Bastille.
Okay, and the Bastille, we should explain, is a French prison for those of you who are not up on your French history.
Yes, well... I don't know if that's like having to explain the gulag. I think we're all right.
Okay. Well, those of you who are not up on your journalism history, Mike Wallace died at 93 years old over the weekend.
Yes. Anytime you see somebody on local news chasing after someone and saying, excuse me, sir, would you like to comment on, you know, or, you know, coming into their business and revealing a scam, that's sort of a tribute to Mike Wallace, who sort of invented the, you know, ambulance chasing cameraman going after an interview sort of approach.
But then he wound up, I mean, he was a journalist on 60 Minutes.
He was the very first guy they hired.
Right. And he wound up interviewing, you know, world leaders and some of the world's biggest names. I think one of his last interviews was with the president of Iran.
Well, no, yeah, he always got big people. I mean, he was one of the early people to interview Barbara Streisand.
Oh, okay.
Interviewed numerous times over the years. And he always got good names, but he was, I think, best known, even on 60 Minutes, for, you know, bringing in businessmen where they go, I can talk my way past Mike Wallace. For decades, they'd think, he's not going to get me. And then he'd sit down with them and drop the hammer and, you know, break them down.
He'd always kind of bring up the one thing, like, if you were interviewing Michael Jackson, which I don't think he ever did, you know, he would have brought up, do you really, I mean, sleep with, what are you doing? You're a grown man. You know, like, he would actually bring all of those topics right out of the closet and waltz them before the subject.
Yeah, you know, he's a serious journalist, a good journalist, though he opened the door to a lot of stuff that probably people regret a little bit in some ways in the future, the way sort of attack journalism or things like that that seem others have used less well than he.
Well, we certainly won't be practicing any attack journalism on today's show, where we actually just kind of regurgitate.
We don't have any guests, or we would.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, that's true. We don't have any guests. Thank you for pointing that out. But it was a holiday week, in our own defense. But we do have some numbers on Spotify. You know, last week we talked about some of those numbers. Apparently, we were too early because Spotify decided they were going to help us out. And they released some cold, hard, fuzzy figures last week. They didn't exactly, you know, pin down some precise numbers, but they told us that they were over certain amounts. Speaking of numbers, on Broadway, Easter proved to be a big week. And I know, Michael, you've got a lot of news there. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. In fact, we were a little lazy this week and put most of the stories in our lightning round. We'll end with an interesting email from one of our listeners who tries to explain the legal concept of unjust enrichment. And I shouldn't say try to explain. He does explain it. It's really, we try to understand it. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
And the number one movie at the box office around the world is The Hunger Games, which grossed $59 million worldwide. It's at $460 million and counting. It has $300 million in the U.S. and another $160 million overseas. So it's, you know, doing very well in the U.S. But people who say it's falling behind overseas, $160 million overseas is pretty darn good for this property. People would have been thrilled with that result, except in the context of how well it's doing in North America. But if you look back at the first Twilight, you can see the first Twilight did very poorly overseas in comparison to the North American box office. But that introduced people to the franchise, which they weren't as familiar with, just like they aren't as familiar with the books, The Hunger Games. And come the second movie, overseas exploded. And that's what pushed Twilight up into like the $700 million category worldwide for the next four movies. So we could very well see the same thing happen for The Hunger Games. Number two around the world is Wrath of the Titans, just a smidge behind the number Hunger Games. It grossed $58 million worldwide, and it's at $211 million and counting. And number three is the reissue of Titanic in 3D, mostly. It's also in 2D. It grossed $53 million worldwide. That's over the weekend. It has $61 million total when you include its North American debut on Wednesday. At number four around the world is American Reunion, the sequel to American Pie and all those sequels. That's at $41 million worldwide. At number five is Dr. Seuss's The Lorax. That's at $17 million worldwide. It's at $257 million and counting. At number six is 21 Jump Street, the comic reboot of the TV drama. That's at $15 million worldwide, or $137 million and counting.
Wait, it made $15 million worldwide this past weekend.
It made $15 million worldwide, and it's at a total of $137 million and counting.
That's not bad for a movie that really only cost, what, like $50 million to make?
Well, $50 million isn't pennies. I think it costs closer to $40 million, but I could be wrong. Yeah, and it's certainly not as well-known a property. I don't know how it did in syndication overseas. I shouldn't say that. Maybe it's a worldwide famous property. But, you know, it was a modest hit series, so it's not like it was a huge property. It did launch the career of Johnny Depp. But, yeah, it's a good, solid reboot for that movie, for that number. They've tripled their budget worldwide. That's always a good start. At number seven worldwide is Mirror, Mirror, which has basically opened in North America. It grossed $11 million for the Julia Roberts comic drama. And it's at $36 million and counting. And number eight is a movie, an animated film that's only opened overseas so far. It's called The Pirates, Band of Misfits. It grossed $10 million, and it's at $25 million and counting.
You know, actually, over the weekend, I was doing some research on ratings agencies, like the Motion Picture Association of America, but mm-hmm. overseas. And I was trying to figure out in certain territories what certain films were rated so that I could tell whether I had the right rating list. It was, long story short, I kept running across this movie, The Pirates, Band of Misfits, which was rated all audiences in most territories. And I was trying to think, when did that movie ever get released in the United States? And then I realized it hasn't.
Don't you listen to your own show?
It's like, I'm just thinking, wow, that movie did poorly here in the U.S. I've never even heard of it.
It's coming out soon. At number nine is John Carter, which is still holding on worldwide, though, again, it's fallen very quickly, very fast. It's at $8 million. With $260 million worldwide total and counting. Its overseas has tripled North America, but that's cold comfort since North America is so darn low. At number 10, another movie that grossed $8 million, the box office in France is really on fire. Their homegrown product has really been very, very successful. This animated slash live-action hybrid is called Ooba, On the Trail of the Marsupilami. It's apparently based on a comic book series about a mythical marsupial with a really long tail. And it opened to $8 million in France, so it's doing very well. And at number 11 worldwide is The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel. That grossed $5 million, and it's at $53 million and counting.
Now, I know your mother is really looking forward to that film. Yeah,
yes, she is.
As am I. And when the heck is it being released
May,
here?
It comes in early May.
All right. I'll have to wait until May, though. Now, you know, let's go back to Wrath of the Titans. Came in number two worldwide with $58 million this past weekend. You want to know why they keep making movies that get critically panned and you know, everybody kind of makes fun of them. Yet $211 million worldwide on a
$150 million budget. It's a big budget.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, they've made their money back.
Well, no, that's not how it works.
Well, no, I mean, think about it. Once that film, it'll probably top out at around close to $300 million.
Oh, I don't see why it can't go beyond that. It made $58 million this weekend. So, I mean, you know, we'll have to see.
Right. So think about it. DVD is all gravy at that point.
Well, we have to see where it ends up worldwide box office. And DVD, of course, is a lot less than it used to be.
Yeah, that's true. You know, so Hunger Games, first off, I on Sunday morning wake up, open my email, and sure enough, there's The Hollywood Reporter and The LA Times, both with the same box office headlines. Hunger Games sinks Titanic 3D, American Reunion. I'm like, really? You couldn't come up with something less?
Sinks? What's wrong with sinks? That's perfectly fine.
But they both literally had the same headline.
Yeah, Titanic had a very strong debut. It grossed $25 million in its first 5 days in North America, which is pretty great. Phantom Menace, for example, only grossed $43 million total. Beauty and the Beast grossed $47 million total. The Lion King is the really big winner. That grossed $94 million in North America and $168 million worldwide when you add everything together. So Titanic, at $61 million worldwide after its first 5 days, is well on its way to being, you know, perhaps the second most successful reissue.
And okay, so that's money. Why you were mentioning The Lion King and Beauty and the Beast and Star Wars, because those were all reissues, kind of converting a 2D film into a 3D film.
That's right. Did you see it?
I have not. I shouldn't say I have not. I have seen most of it, but in chunks, which is exactly the way I had seen The Hunger Games up until this past weekend. Because, you know, as it went through various stages of conversion, I had, you know, seen different bits and pieces of it. So I'd seen 20 minutes here, 40 minutes there, a 30-minute press preview. But I know you saw it last week. So what do you think?
I was pretty nonplussed.
Really? Okay. Because most people are saying, even the people who don't like Titanic and they hate 3D are saying, actually, it looks pretty amazing.
Well, I thought the trailer looked really good and it did definitely look 3D-ish. But once I saw the whole film, the 3D added nothing. You know, it just didn't matter. I mean, it's a big spectacle movie. You would think this would be the movie where, oh my gosh, 3D is really gonna, it made no difference. And in fact, I heard some people say that after the movie, even girls who were happy to be there and squealed for Leonardo DiCaprio, they were like, well, the 3D added nothing, but it was still a great movie. That's how they felt. I watched this, and in fact, I thought the 3D hurt the film because there were a couple key moments where you're far more aware of the elements that they've joined together. You know, when they create a special effects movie, you might have you might shoot a person standing there in front of a blue screen, and then you add in the big giant ship sinking in the water. What happens in the 3D is you separate those out a little bit more. So there were scenes like when the ship was being launched, you could see people on the dock and then the boat was pulling out. Because of the 3D, you were far more aware that it was a special effect. Same thing happened in the water a number of times when people were in boats looking at the ship and it was tilting up and sinking. You were just far more aware that this was like a separate element. It was not all taking place in the same place at the same time. The 3D worked against the desire to make everything seamlessly look like it was happening at the same time. Anytime you're on the ship and you're sort of looking up at the stars, again, it felt very artificial and separate. And the 3D emphasized that. And I thought it made the movie less effective on a technical level. As a spectacle, it's still, you know, it is what it is. It's not a very good movie. It's an okay romantic tearjerker, if that's what you're into. But I really did think the 3D hurt the film as far as its special effects.
Well, you know, speaking of the stars, you know, Neil deGrasse Tyson, who is an astrophysicist, and I guess he's, you know, a popular science guy, he kind of held James Cameron to task because he said when he first saw the movie, he looked at, wait a second, it was April. The stars never would have looked like that in April in that part of the world.
100 years earlier? Okay.
So in 1997, when the film was released and Neil deGrasse Tyson saw this, he kind of took James Cameron
to task.
And he turned around and James Cameron said, all right, yeah, so B, I'll change it. Tell me what it should have been. And he did actually change it.
Oh, that's very funny.
That's the one thing he said he changed. The one little, you know, all the wooden stick figures walking on the planks of the Titanic, on the decks of the Titanic, that he kept. The stars he changed.
What do you mean? I mean, wooden stick figures. I don't know what you mean. Well, you mean that he didn't try and improve the special effects by redoing things like Lucas. He just turned it into 3D.
Correct, yes.
But $28 million, it's a big gross in North America. That's practically what it made on its opening 3D weekend back in December of 1997. So nice symmetry there.
Well, I would imagine there are fewer people seeing it this past weekend.
Given... Oh my gosh, you and your figures. We know. Ticket prices are more.
Well, you know, I finally saw The Hunger Games in its entirety. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, I know you weren't, you were nonplussed by that film, but you know, even afterwards, it is the kind of film that causes one to have a conversation afterwards. Yes, it's child on child violence and it's very violent, although they did a good job of kind of putting that, it was implied violence most of the time.
Yeah.
But it's definitely, I could see why the books are so popular and I can see why the movie is popular because it's an interesting and intriguing subject.
Yeah, I think he really was poor with the action scenes, but we'll talk more about Gary Ross, the director, when we get down to Big Deal, Big Whoop.
Oh, that's a good point, and I would tend to agree with you. The man loved his close-ups. That is for sure. But, you know, you just mentioned that I really like figures, but you know what I really don't like is getting them wrong. And last week, we were talking about Spotify, which we talk about, in my opinion, way too much on this show, but we'll talk about it one more time at least, because last week, Spotify sent Evolver.fm some numbers, and they said, look, we've got over 3 million paid subscribers, and they didn't say where those subscribers are. Let's keep in mind that they're in 13 different countries right now.
Well, it means worldwide, so who cares?
Yeah, okay. They said they have over 10 million active users, which, now that's an important number, because if you look at Facebook, 17.5 million people have installed the Spotify application. Now, last September, Spotify said, hey, look, if you want to join Spotify, it's free and you can do so, but you have to log in with your Facebook password. And it kind of then forced you to share some of your music and what you were listening to with people on Facebook, although you could turn that feature off. Now, Spotify only started that in September, so that means that there's 17.5 million people who have registered for Spotify since then. But we have no idea how many people registered before then. Like, I registered long before they required a Facebook login. So it could be more people. But what's interesting is, okay, so there's at least 17.5 million people who registered for Spotify, but only 10 million active users.
Well, but only 10 million worldwide, right?
I guess that's what they're saying, yes.
Right. So, that doesn't mean all those, it could be 2 million could come from Facebook. You were already an active member before Facebook. So
that's true.
Right. So they, tens of millions of people registered and technically could make use of it via Facebook, but a lot of them haven't done so yet.
Yeah. And I guess the reason that they wanted to kind of say, hey, look, we only have 10 million active users, even though, like, you know, 17.5 filled out the Facebook stuff and it looks like we have more active users. Really, the active user base is 10 million, which means our conversion rate is 30%.
Well, I didn't think they were touting that to show how low it was.
Well, no, what they didn't want to do is say, oh, we actually have like 20 million active users and we only have 3 million paid subscribers. But even so, you know, a 15 to 17.5, you know, conversion rate is nothing to sneeze at.
Right. So 20,000 songs added per day. What does that mean?
Yeah, that's remarkable. 20,000 songs are added each day and they have 300,000 record labels participating. That's just, I mean, I didn't even know there were 300,000 record labels in the world.
So there aren't 300,000 record labels. There may be 300,000 artists who have put up an individual song, but there aren't certainly 300,000 active record labels with multiple artists. You know, that just means if I have a band and I get my song on Spotify, I'm a record label.
Right,
you
know? Exactly. So it's like those people who release like one or two tracks.
But at least 300,000 different people, including some major record labels, have signed up. So that's, you know, it's better than none. It's like there are millions of people who have books on Amazon, but there are not millions of publishers.
Right, exactly. You
know? But 20,000 songs, that means 20,000 new songs are added every day?
Yes.
Is that what that means?
Yes.
They could be catalog or they could be brand new songs that I wrote in my bathroom, but they are songs that have not been on Spotify before. Well, that's interesting.
Yes, that is interesting, but is it as interesting as Pandora listenership growing 59%?
Well, 59% from what to what? That's what I want to know.
I have no idea. They didn't say, actually.
Well, they do, don't they?
Oh, actually, I apologize. You're right. They did. They grew to 51 million.
So that means they were at like 30, 40 million?
Oh, you see, I'm already going to get dinged on trying to like do half of 20%. Conversion rate on Spotify.
60% and they're at $51 million total users, active listeners. There you go.
Active listeners, yeah.
And so that kicks, obviously, Spotify's ass.
Well, right. But, you know, it's kind of a double-edged sword when you think about it for Pandora. The more successful they are, the more licensing fees they have to pay to record labels, and they're already not profitable.
Well, the same is true for Spotify. They paid they've paid out $250 million to record labels since their launch.
Yes, that's true. That is true. Yeah, well, yeah, but they pay in advance.
Okay, it's still money, right?
Well, yeah, that's true. I guess in a way, Pandora has the better deal because if they're not successful, they don't pay.
Oh, you're saying Spotify is not linked to actual usage?
I think that they're paying up front.
Isn't that like paying your rent? I mean, they're paying up front, but it's paid out based on usage. And if they don't, you know, have that much usage, they won't have to keep paying that money, obviously, right? They'd still have a credit left over, right?
Right. It's kind of like saying to your landlord, look, I'm going to pay you $500 for this month's rent. But if I only stay in the apartment for 2 days this month.
Well, we don't know what Spotify's deal is. Is that what you're telling me?
Right. Exactly.
OK.
But I would have. I mean, it was a big deal that they even a big deal that they got deals.
Have any idea how much Pandora has paid out or what their bill is right now?
No, I don't think so. But they are a public company, so it wouldn't be hard to find out.
But the more money they spend, the more listeners they have, the more money they have to spend out to record labels.
That's right. And the amount of time that people spend listening to Pandora has increased to more than 1 billion hours in March, which is, you know, from 567 million hours in March 2011. So it's almost doubled itself.
Which makes sense that they've added 60% more people.
That's true. Yeah. And, you know, really, that might go down in a way, because I think a lot of people are listening to Pandora at work. I know, you know, when I go to get a haircut, it's Pandora's music on the radio, which I'm sure is probably illegal. However, they do have a commercial subscription. Procter & Gamble this past week decided to block Pandora and Netflix in their offices so that employees can't listen to music and can't be watching movies. They noticed that like a quarter of all their bandwidth in some of their offices was going to those two services.
Well, why not block it then? Absolutely.
I couldn't agree more. But
so basically, looking at it overall, Pandora versus Spotify, Pandora seems to be ahead still?
Well, at least in usage, absolutely.
And Spotify is capitalizing somewhat on Facebook?
Oh, they most definitely are, yes.
Well, but we don't know how many they've added via Facebook. We don't have any...
Well, 17.5 million people.
Yeah, but that's just they just registered. We don't know how many people are actually turning into active listeners or paid subscribers.
That's right. And we have no idea really where those... Yes, exactly. I'm about to say the same exact thing that you just said, so I'm going to stop talking right now.
So which one do you use more? Which do you like better?
Well, this past week I was using, in preparation for Coachella, I was using Spotify quite a bit because you can actually pick the playlist and say, okay, I want to listen to the Coachella Day 3 playlist that somebody's created and actually bone up on all the bands that are going to be there.
Oh, that's cool. And you can't do that on Pandora?
Well, you could say, well, I'd like to create a channel that is a Fits in the Tantrums channel, but then, you know, you won't necessarily get just Coachella artists. And maybe they have a Coachella station. I'm sure they do, but I haven't really spent the time to look for it.
Okay.
But now, speaking of figures, I know you've got
We're still speaking of figures? Oh, boy.
Yeah, well, I know you've got a huge list of figures from The Great White Way.
Well, the holidays are always big for Broadway. Christmas week and New Year's week is the biggest week of the year for Broadway. There are some other really big holidays. The actual days themselves tend to be low, but every day around it, families around, people around, and sometimes they go to Broadway. Easter week is a very big week on Broadway. Not that I was quite aware of that, but this Easter week had a big jumps in the box office for Broadway. Three shows were over $2 million at the box office. That's Wicked, The Lion King, two, you know, blockbuster mainstays, and yes, Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark, which grossed more than $2 million at the box office.
Now, don't you mean Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark?
That's right. Even if it costs $1 million a week, which is what we think might be the nut, that is the amount of money it costs to run that show every week.
Which would be huge, by the way. That's no small figure there.
Huge, very, very huge. The biggest on Broadway, as far as we know. That's because they have so many people and the stunt people and such a big back room with a lot of tech people. That's a very big amount of money to cost to run the show every week. But even if it does cost them $1 million, they grossed $1 million last week. Another show that grossed, say, $300,000, they take 3 weeks or a month to make that amount of money. So Spider-Man is still chugging along. And I have friends coming to town, and one of the shows they wanted to see that they're thinking of is Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark. So tourists are liking the show and coming to it. It's getting good word of mouth.
It's kind of mandatory. It's like, go see the Empire State Building, to the Statue of Liberty, go to see Spider-Man.
No, I wouldn't say that. It's just doing very well.
Okay.
But, you know, Book of Mormon is also on their list, but that show is just sold out. That had set another house record. I think it's 30th or 39th or something like that. It's in a very small Broadway house. It grossed $1.59 million, which is a ton. And it's at 102.6% capacity, which means a lot of people are sitting on other people's laps, I guess. But a couple other shows grossed more than $1 million. Mary Poppins, Evita, which is a revival that just opened to so-so reviews, and The Phantom of the Opera. They all made over $1 million. So there were seven shows in the $1 million club. And right under that is Newsies, another show that just opened up. It's been sold out every week since the day it opened in previews. It's just been red hot. They've been slowly raising their ticket prices. You know, they start off in previews usually with some discounts, though Evita didn't do that because it's been in massive demand from the get-go. But Newsies started off maybe selling an average of $60 per ticket and then $70, $75. It's slowly inching its way up the charts in box office gross, but it has sold every single ticket every day to every show since the minute it opened.
And this is the Broadway musical starring a young Christian Bale.
That's right. It stars Jeremy Jordan. It's based on the film starring Christian Bale, and it's proven a really, really hot property. It started off Broadway in New Jersey, intended genuinely to be just a touring production and to create a show that they could sell to high schools and colleges and community theater for people who wanted to put on shows. They wanted to turn it into a valuable property. A lot of money gets made when shows are sold and licensed out to so that community theater and high schools can mount that show. They mount Damn Yankees and Bye Bye Birdie and all these other shows again and again. And Newsies, Disney said they thought this could be a valuable property. And they turned it into a musical with the desire to tour it and to make it a name property that high schools and other people could mount and put on their own. And it worked out much better than that and went right to Broadway.
You know, I'm still trying to get over the fact that you just went right past my poor joke there about Christian Bale. But that's true. Now, speaking of, first off, Broadway shows that tour and Broadway shows that may not make it to high schools, I saw American Idiot over the weekend. It's touring and it arrived here in Los Angeles, and that will never play at a high school.
Well, it's an adult show. It's not intended. It's drug addiction. It's all sorts of things. There are plenty of shows that, Next to Normal was on Broadway. That's not going to come to high schools. Or there are shows that are just too elaborate, really, like Wicked. I don't believe that maybe they've created a high school production, or Lion King. Those shows are not suited for high school. They involve too much technical work. Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark Again will never, be made available in a version that high schools can mount because it just doesn't work. So there are a lot of shows like that. But how was American Idiot?
I thought, wow, it's kind of interesting that they were able to turn all of this music, which was written by Green Day and Billy Joe Armstrong of Green Day, and they turned it into a musical, which you wouldn't think could happen. This like punk rock music as Broadway musical just seemed completely unfathomable. And yet they were able to do that. What they weren't able to do was really get a halfway decent story. There was little to no story at all. I like the fact that, and I don't know, maybe they didn't do this on Broadway. I would imagine they did. There was no intermission. They played straight through, and that the band was on the stage. So they did a lot of interesting new things, and yet there really wasn't a story there.
I heard it was visually good, and I love the album. I think the album's great, but I didn't see the show, so I'll take your word on it. But I'd heard the same thing, that it was more of a song cycle than an actual show.
Yeah, I mean, they tried to put a storyline and hang a storyline on the songs, and they did a halfway decent job. But then when you leave, you kind of go, there really was no story here, was there?
And of course, it's Easter week, so I should say another show that did really well was Jesus Christ Superstar. It's his week, for God's sake. So, that show did extremely well, had its best week by far, but it also got very poor reviews, just like Evita, which did not get good reviews. And I imagine it might collapse after Easter, just the way like Christmas-themed movies collapse after, Christmas is over and we're in January. No one wants to see a Christmas-themed movie in January. I think the same fate might happen to Jesus Christ Superstar, but we'll have to see.
Well, what is the deal? Andrew Lloyd Webber's revivals just can't make any... Well, they
certainly... No, Evita's doing great. Evita is tearing it up. Evita has made $1.2, $1.4 million. Since the second it opened, it's been doing terrific box office. It just did not get a lot of love from critics. The star is a woman from Argentina. She became a star in London when she took over the role. Ricky Martin is in the show. He's a big Latin star. And Michael Cerveris, who is a terrific actor and got the best reviews probably of anyone, plays Juan Perón, her husband, and he got good reviews. The show got mixed reviews for this production and even some mixed reviews for the show itself, which is probably Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice's best work together. That's a low bar, but that's probably true. But it just did not get very good reviews, but audiences don't care. They're going to it. So
I saw Jesus Christ Superstar. It was good.
It got very poor reviews on Broadway. It got good reviews when it was in Canada at Stratford, or where was it? I forget.
Yeah, I think it was Stratford, and then it came to La Jolla, which is where I saw it, at the La Jolla Playhouse, and it was decent.
I thought it was terrible, yeah. I'm not a single person that show could sing except for Judas. Most of the cast is the same, I believe, is what you saw. The actor who played Judas, forgive me for forgetting his name, had a very good voice, and no one else could sing.
Mary Magdalene could not sing.
Yeah. Well, it's a musical.
Mary Magdalene, I thought, was the weakest of the cast. And
she couldn't sing or act. But Jesus had nothing to do. He had like a rock star voice. You know, he'd go up on a high squeal every once in a while. But like supporting actor after person could not sing.
Well, Judas is a rock star. Judas is literally a rock star. Like when you actually look at his bio, and he had, you know, albums for sale out in the lobby, and you know, he was literally, you looked at Judas and went, yeah, he's the one that's going to make it.
Well, yeah, but you're all supposed to be able to sing in a Broadway show.
Yeah, although remember the way this was kind of started was just as a show in Stratford that then they decided to bring to La Jolla and everybody.
No. They had Des McAniff, a major Broadway figure, directing that show in Stratford. This wasn't a little kid that could. This is with a major big director. They always had big plans for this.
Oh, really?
You know, it doesn't matter. Wherever you stage it, people should be able to sing. There are plenty of talented people. There's no excuse not to have good singers in it.
Yeah, just look at American Idol. They should have done a Canadian Idol and pick people out of that.
They've done that in the UK quite a bit, where they have a new show like The Sound of Music or some other show, and they have those people. They cast the lead role by having a reality show. Andrew Lloyd Webber's done it at least twice and had good success with it. You know, as far as box office, and sometimes finding people who actually become good, talented people. But
why
you know.
Have they not done that here? That sounds like such a good idea. I'd watch that show for at least one episode.
They did do it. They did it for Grease is the Word.
Oh, that's right.
They've done it on Broadway. It just was not a big hit. We should say Josh Young is the actor who plays Judas Iscariot. I think we'll see him again on Broadway or somewhere else. Everybody else, have a nice life.
Well, a nice life in Canada, which is where they came from in the first place.
Yeah, we have a big spring. There's a lot of shows opening on Broadway. Matthew Broderick is proving a draw in Nice Work If You Can Get It, which is a new musical built around the songs of the Gershwins. It hasn't opened yet. Ghost is coming up. That's a big question mark. It got horrible reviews in the UK, and we'll probably get horrible reviews here. And
I don't think anybody's going to see Ghost. Get it?
Well, Ghost is doing okay at the box office.
Get it? Come on. Yeah. Anybody's going to see it?
Oh, I get it.
Yeah.
It's doing okay at the box office, as is A Streetcar Named Desire, an all-black revival of that show starring Blair Underwood, and One Man, Two Governors, which is a British comedy coming to America. It's very funny. I saw it in London.
Wait a second. Isn't it One Man, Two Governors?
Two Governors, that's right.
Yeah,
but
okay.
There are a number of shows opening up that are about to open up that have really nobody is going to see these shows. Probably the most notable is Magic Bird, which is a drama about the friendship between Larry Bird and Magic Johnson, the two basketball stars. One of the more unlikely ideas for a Broadway show. And everybody thought, what is this going to be? And it opens on Thursday. But in fact, everyone who's seen it, including me, says, I don't know about that.
Oh, so you've seen the show.
Yeah, I have. I won't review it till Thursday, but I wouldn't rush to the box office.
Is it like the 8-bit video game that was, you know, the Atari Smash one-on-one?
I wouldn't know.
Back in the 80s, there was a video game that was called One-on-One, and it was Dr. J versus Larry Bird, and it was an 8-bit, and so it looked pretty crummy.
That's one of the lowest grossing and lowest potential. I mean, they're selling tickets for like $15 to that show. They cannot get anybody to walk in the door of that show. Same thing with The Lions, unfortunately, which is a play by Nikki Silver, a fixture off Broadway. It's his first show to come to Broadway. It stars Linda Lavin, who's a very well-respected and well-thought-of Broadway star, and of course, the star of the sitcom Alice. And it got great reviews off Broadway. I imagine when it opens, if it gets great reviews on Broadway, it might turn it around and become a big hit. But so far, they have not been able to attract people to the show at all. Not enough advertising, not enough attention. Who knows what's going on? But, you know, it was a big leap for Nikki Silver to come to Broadway with a show. And unfortunately, they're not getting anybody in the door.
So you're saying Linda Lavin on Broadway is kind of a big deal?
No. Well, she should be a big deal. She's very well respected. In fact, she chose to do this show rather than, oh my gosh, what's the name of that show? She was in a show at Lincoln Center and it transferred to Broadway and she decided.
South Pacific.
Keep going.
I'm going through the list of shows that were once at Lincoln Center. 6 Degrees of Separation.
Keep going. There it is. Other Desert Cities, a fine drama, which she had a great supporting role. And she walked away from that show. And also another show that she was, they wanted her to star in, to do this off-Broadway show in a small house. And it's now transferring to Broadway. And she'll probably get a nomination for Best Actress in a Drama. And hopefully that'll be a triumph for her. But right now she's playing two nearly empty houses, which is very sad. So it's a big whoop that the show has come to Broadway, but Linda Lavin is a star and she should be able to pull people in once the reviews arrive.
And it'll be a big deal when she's nominated for a Tony and she appears on the Tony Awards show with Neil Patrick Harris, who will be hosting the show this year again for the third time.
That's right. That will be a big deal.
Okay, well, it is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story is about network dramas at 10 p.m. Apparently, they just can't compete with DVRs. The major networks are facing a black hole at 10 p.m. They haven't had a major hit now in some time, in years, really. And nothing on the scale of NBC's ER or LA Law. What is the culprit? Two things. First, bad shows. That's the very first culprit. Cable channels have serious hits at 10 p.m., like The Walking Dead and Justified, but network TV hasn't come close to a buzzworthy 10 p.m. drama. Second, the DVR. People get home from work, they dive into TV, and apparently at 10 p.m., they start to whittle away at the backlog on their DVR. It's hard enough to compete with Don Draper or Zombies. But what show can compete with a DVR filled with every other show that aired in the last week that people want to watch but haven't seen yet? Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. I don't know why it would be limited to just 10 p.m. I don't know why they're blaming 10 p.m. Downtime on the DVR. I don't watch TV at 9 or 8 o'clock either. I watch strictly DVR. So
actually, I can explain that. I do know. So they call that the catch-up hour.
The West Coast? I understand what they say.
No,
but,
meaning that people get home. They get home around 5, 6 o'clock, right? They prepare dinner. They usually sit down at around, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock. And they start watching the 8 o'clock shows at 9 o'clock and the 9 o'clock shows at 10 o'clock. And that's what's happening. And that's what TiVo has been reporting is happening.
And they're watching the 10 o'clock shows the next day or not at all?
Correct.
But I mean, why did they start at 9? Would they have stuff from earlier in the day or the day before? I mean, I don't just watch that night's programming that night. A lot of people watch 3 days or 7 days later. We can see millions of people added 7 days later to all the big network shows. 40% of Modern Family's audience watches it after it, the day after it airs, or 2 days or three, up to 7 days after it airs. Modern Family airs on Wednesday. That means Thursday they start to watch the Wednesday programming. Again, I don't understand why 10 p.m. is the loser there. If there's a show on at 10 that I like Justified or Walking Dead, I might watch it the next night at 8 o'clock. It's not, I don't say, I only want to watch 8 or 9 o'clock shows. If it's on my DVR and I want to watch it, I watch it. The problem is Parenthood. The problem is, LA Law umpteenth. The problem is CSI, whatever. It's all these shows that have been around or feel tired and old, and they're not making good shows. I think that's the real culprit.
And then you have people like me who still have 8 episodes of Lost on their DVR.
Not Lost. You have 8 episodes of the Dinosaur Show.
Yeah, Terra Nova. I have 6 episodes of Terra Nova that I have. I think I deleted.
You don't really
those.
Have 8 episodes of Lost, do you?
Yeah, I still don't know how that show ended. Please don't tell me. Don't write in and tell me. Don't spoil it. I'm going to start watching it.
What are you waiting for?
Oh, it's one of those things where, I'll get to it. I'll get to it.
How do you have room on your DVR that you could keep all those old shows on?
I have no idea. I'll be honest. Well, earlier in the show, you mentioned that we'd be talking about director Gary Ross, and he helmed one of the most successful film launches of all time. And unlike Catherine Hardwicke, his movie actually got pretty good reviews. Now, Catherine Hardwicke, of course, was Twilight. She directed the first Twilight. But Ross and Lionsgate are playing hardball with one another now. Ross took only $3 million to both write and direct The Hunger Games. However, according to The Hollywood Reporter, he gets 5% of the back end. That means at least $23 million total, at least to date. But
Is that 5% of gross?
I would imagine it's net. I can't imagine there.
But then net means he makes nothing.
Well, that's true. So I have no idea. I mean, I have to read that contract. But I mean, these days, a gross deal, that's kind of unheard of. But, Lionsgate may see Ross as disposable and just hire another director because really it's the material that's attracting people. Will the director sign up for less given the blockbuster status of the franchise? Another problem, Jennifer Lawrence is also set to make the next X-Men, that kind of prequel sequel. They've announced a start date of January 2013, which means Catching Fire needs a start date of August. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a very big deal. First, I'm not sure if he would just take $3 million and 5% of net. I mean, 5% of net would mean you get nothing, basically.
Well, for $1 million.
You will make, Yeah, but $3 million is nothing for, him. I think they were happy to get him because they thought he's a bigger name, you know, Pleasantville and other movies. He's not a likely choice. I'm not sure how he got pegged in the first place, but hey, it made a lot of money.
Did he direct Seabiscuit? He did direct Seabiscuit. Yeah.
Terrific Oscar-nominated film. But, you know, really, I mean, $3 million is, you know, a small amount, but it's not a huge budget movie. 5% of gross, which is what I assume it is, because net would be meaningless. That means he does get, like, $23 million when all is said and done, at least. So that would be a great deal. If I was him, I'd say I'll take the same deal for number two, especially since you imagine the worldwide box office could jump just like the Twilight movies.
Right, but they probably want him to take $3 million and no profit participation.
Well, they're not going to do, he's not going to do that, obviously.
Right.
You know, he's not going to $500-$600 million. And no, what other director is going to step in and say, okay, I'll take, you know, they'll obviously have to pay more for whomever directs part two.
Well, I hope that whoever directs it has a wide angle lens, because the number of close-ups in that movie that were confusing, you know, I couldn't count them.
Yeah, I thought he did a very poor job on the action scenes, but we'll have to see if I was them, I'd want him to stick around. Why mess with a good thing?
Speaking of sticking around, late night ratings are declining all over thanks to massive increased competition with the DVR, as we were just talking about. But late night talk shows are still valuable properties, and CBS has signed up David Letterman and Craig Ferguson through 2014. Though both shows have declined from their peaks, which Letterman hit his second season at CBS in, get this, 1992, which was before Leno passed him again for good. And Ferguson enjoyed his peak in 2006, his record season as well. Letterman will get some $28 million, and Ferguson will get $12 million a year and a new, larger studio. Letterman will be host for 32 years at the end of that contract, which beats his mentor Johnny Carson's record of 30 years in late-night television. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. They're both, you know, making money. Of course, they're going to sign them up some more. Ferguson, I think, has he's sort of the heir apparent. When Letterman decides to retire, if he ever does, Ferguson, it's assumed, will be moving to the 11:30 slot. That's clearly not going to happen anytime soon. Was there any temptation for him to go elsewhere? No, nor should there have been. You know, he's making a lot of money. He's happy, low pressure, can do whatever he wants, having a great time. I'm stunned that they both have peaked so many years ago, but there's so many more late night talk shows. Jimmy Kimmel, Conan O'Brien, Jay Leno, David Letterman, Craig Ferguson, all the cable channels have shows like, you know, Colbert and all these other things chipping away at them. There's just a ton of competition in late night. So when you look at the total viewers, Leno is still on top. He draws 3.6 million viewers. Letterman's at 3.2 million. I can't believe that he peaked so many years ago. But Jon Stewart is at third. He's with 2.4 million viewers. But when you look at the big demo that only advertisers care about, which is 18 to 49-year-olds, which I will soon not be in anymore, so I hate this. But in that demo, Jon Stewart is number one. He reaches 1.3 million viewers, which is exactly why he makes a ton of money as well, because he is the biggest host in the only demo that advertisers care about.
Yeah, you know, it's funny that you should say that, that you know, I'm in my 40s now, but I'm a young 40. I too go, well, gee, what's going to happen in a couple years when I'm no longer in my 40s?
Well, you know, first of all, I've always been opposed to the focus on that demo. I've always thought it was stupid. Even when I was 15 or 20, I thought, what do you mean? People in their teens have money. People who are over 49 have money. They have a lot of money. The idea was used to be that, oh, they're stuck in their ways and they buy oatmeal from Quaker Oats and they never are going to change because they're 50. And I think that's just so antiquated, you know, that I think it's crazy. But
I think the baby boomers, as they age, that's actually going to be proven, because there will be more of them and that will be a larger market. And I think the baby boomers are a little bit more, not necessarily set in their ways, but they're willing to give up their feature phone for a smartphone. I mean, I saw two people who were in their 60s with iPhones, like going, oh, let me show you this app.
And I thought, right. What yeah, the exactly. Heck? Well, I mean, clearly, you know, total viewers matter. I understand why people parse the numbers, but hey, you know, that people got a lot of money in a lot of age groups. It's silly to me to focus so narrowly on just that one middle demo. However, I saw a funny thing about that. It was about MSNBC, I think, or CNBC. Was it CNBC? How their ratings collapsed one quarter. Nobody could figure out why their ratings had collapsed. They were like, going, what's going on? Nothing's changed. Their programming hasn't changed. The competition hasn't changed. Everybody else has sort of stayed the same, but their ratings have just fallen through the floor in this important 18 to 49 demo. And somebody drilled down to figure it out. And if their sample size is so small that three people in the Nielsen families, three people had turned 50. Three people. But because cable business channels get such small audience, those three people turning 50 suddenly had this extrapolating effect that it looked like CNBC's audience had collapsed. And the Nielsen sample size is so small that it threw off their ratings.
Yeah, they need people meters.
They need to just check everybody. I don't understand with cable boxes why everybody can't be part of the mix.
Because once you start, well, I agree with you, but once you start doing that, then you really probably don't want to know what the truth is.
But you do. It's just like BookScan. It's just like Billboard charts. When you can see what people are actually watching and actually buying at the checkout counter, the albums they're buying, you go, oh my God, country's really popular.
That's right.
You say, oh my God, this book is really, you find out great, interesting things. What matters is the truth. So I don't think they should be afraid of that.
Well, you know, that's, Mel Karmazin, when he was, I can't remember what he was the head of, but he went into Google and he said, you know, very early on, and he said, you're messing up you're messing up my magic. And he didn't say messing. He said something else. Because he said, look, you know, my advertisers know, and I want to say he was the head of CBS or some other network, or Viacom. I think he was, I can't remember who he was with. But he had all of these advertisers that knew that 50% of their advertising budget was misspent. They just didn't know which 50%. And Google was telling them exactly which 50%, because they were saying, here's what works, here's what doesn't, down to the click.
Knowledge is power. Our lightning round has become our tortoise round.
That's right. Well, most of our stories are here this week. Now, we do have a story here about digital subscriptions on magazines or digital subscriptions to magazines, really. Now, as you know, Michael, people love their tablets, but have magazines benefited from all the money they poured into creating all these elaborate digital versions that would look spiffy on the iPad? Believe it or not, not yet. According to industry leader, the Bureau of Circulation, I love the name of that group. Once you strip out freebie copies and other giveaways, the number of paid digital subscriptions for the entire industry is less than 1%. A gaming magazine has almost 600,000 digital-only subscribers, and that is the top of the heap there. National Geographic has 68,000 digital subscribers, and that's what a big hit looks like for everyone else. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a very big deal because knowledge is power, like we said. They're spending a ton of money to convert magazines into digital versions, and almost nobody is paying for them. Some people who get access to the digital version, like I have a subscription to The New Yorker, and I get free access to the digital version, which is kind of just a PDF version of the magazine. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about people who pay money just to have a digital subscription. It's very, very tiny. I don't think the payout is that strong. I think making a digital version available to your regular subscribers works, but why pour a lot of money into something if people are not going to be that jazzed up to pay for it?
No, I agree. Now, remember, as you mentioned, The New Yorker, for instance, uses the Adobe Digital Publishing platform, and that's what most of these magazine publishers are using. It's a great platform, and it's really helped a lot of these magazines go digital. Rolling Stone still has yet to go digital, but all of these magazines, like I have Wired and Vanity Fair and Rolling Stone, except for Rolling Stone, they all basically say, look, if you're a subscriber, you get the digital version for free. So they kind of make you buy the print subscription.
But would you ever have any desire to say, I don't need the print subscription? If it was the same price or a little bit less, would you say, okay, I'll just take digital only?
I think I'd want the print subscription just, you know, I think if it was less, yes, but not at the same price.
Okay.
Now, is Vince Vaughn cursed with timeliness? Because last year, his romantic comedy, The Dilemma, got caught up in a firestorm of ill-judged comedy and bad timing. The trailer for the movie had Vaughn referring to a car as quote-unquote gay, just as gay teen suicides and bullying were national headlines. Now, it's happened again. Vaughn stars with Ben Stiller in, get this, Neighborhood Watch, a movie about alien invasion a la Ghostbusters. But the first trailer emphasized Vaughn and Stiller as crime watch vigilantes, which naturally has the studio worried the film might become linked in people's minds to the Trayvon Martin shooting in Florida. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop in the sense of, you know, it's just bad timing for a comedy that comes out in the summer. They're thinking about, should they delay the film and hold it till fall? But by then the trial could be started if there is a trial, or who knows what, you know, there's no good timing. But they did have a trailer which they showed them, you know, shooting up a crime watch sign in the neighborhood, and they pull that trailer. They're just trying to figure out what to do. They're now saying maybe we should just make clear this is all about aliens invading, you know, make sure reveal more what the movie's about, which they were going to hold off probably. It's bad timing. That's all bad timing, bad luck.
Well, you know, this next story, I saw a headline this week that had me believing I was back in the 80s. And you kind of pointed out here in the story because of the people that were mentioned in the headline. So get this. Madonna had a massive first week of sales for her new album, MDNA. It scored almost 359,000 copies. Her best sales week since 2000. And in this day and age, of course, it's a very healthy number. In at number two. Now, here's the kicker. Lionel Richie with his country-themed album Tuskegee. At just under 200,000 copies, his best sales week in the sound scan era, and a higher total in 1 week than the total sales for his last album.
Oh, what a feeling, dancing on the ceiling. I bet he's feeling good.
Yeah, I mean, but when I saw Madonna edges out Lionel Richie for number one, I was like, I'm sorry, is it 1985? I mean, come on. Madonna has now hit number one 8 times, of course, but more than any other female artist in history, except maybe Barbara Streisand. No, definitely.
Definitely.
Well, who has enjoyed, you know, she's Streisand, 9 number one hit albums. Meanwhile, Justin Bieber exploded onto the singles chart with his highest scoring single yet. How many S's can you put in one sentence? Boyfriend debuted at number 2 and sold a massive 521,000 digital downloads, which tells you exactly how the youngsters are getting their music today. The only reason Boyfriend didn't debut at number 1, it's basically not available for streaming, and that gave the edge to current number 1, We Are Young by Fun. Yet another group I've never heard of. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, there's a lot going on here. Lionel Richie repurposed himself by focusing on country music. He took a lot of his familiar hits and recast them in a country vein, including duets with some big country stars. So it's the number one album at country. You would think a black man in country music, but you know, there have been obviously other examples, like Big and Rich have been big country acts, and the guy from Hootie and the Blowfish had a very successful country album. Obviously, Charlie Pride and other country acts. So, you know, Lionel Richie was reaching out to an audience that was ready for him and did a smart move. Madonna has always been a big, huge star. She just came off the biggest world tour in history for a female star. So she clearly had a lot of commercial pull. And what she did was she put out tickets on sale for her new tour. And she said, you're buying tickets to the tour. Do you want to also get a copy of my new album for an extra, you know, $8, $10 or whatever the price might be? And if they did that, you know, people say, well, I'm spending $150 to go see the tour. I might as well get the album. They made it very easy for them to buy the album. This is part of her 360 deal with Ticketmaster. So
actually,
they made
the 360 deals with Live Nation.
I mean, Live Nation, yeah. God forbid. Sorry about that. The Live Nation will come kick my butt. So they made it really easy for adults who aren't necessarily, there's no store to go to anymore. They don't go online that quickly, but they made it easy for adults buying tickets to her tour to buy her new album. People said, well, you know, why not? $10, I should get the album. So that is why she had such a very good first week. It's smart, it's valid, it's reasonable, and it paid off very well. And I'm fascinated by Justin Bieber, how, you know, they're always fiddling with the mix. We've talked about this before, of how they figure out what song is number one. That, you know, they do a combination of radio airplay and online airplay and YouTube video plays and all these and digital downloads. And, you know, they are constantly messing with that formula to try and get as valid a representation of what's the most popular song in the country. It's a lot harder than sales, because sales, you just track down as many sales as you can. But what's the most popular song? That's a lot harder to nail down. And in this case, his song's not available yet on streaming because they want people to buy it. But because it's not available on streaming, he lost a little bit of space in the formula and lost out to the number one song in the country. If it was available to stream, he probably would have had the number one song in the country and probably will next week.
And yet you have Jack White giving away his music in a very unusual manner. He actually tied his these flexi discs of his new solo album to these like helium balloons, and you know, launched 1,000 of them on April Fool's Day from his Nashville record label headquarters. And this is an interesting method of distribution.
Well, it's a fun stunt, but that's Jack White. You know, red, he wears red, she wears white. He tells everybody his wife is his sister. You know, he's great at self-promotion. He's a carny huckster at heart in a way, and obviously a very, very talented musician. But that's a very fun little thing to do, setting them off in balloons to go out to the world, seeding the world with his new album. I like it.
Now, this next story I'm so tired of. In fact, if the Hollywood Reporter is listening, and we know you are, please stop sending me headlines about Keith Olbermann. We understand he's suing Current TV. To no one's surprise, Keith Olbermann, in fact, is suing Current TV. They dumped the anchor, claimed he missed almost half of his work days in the first 2 months of the year. That's, by the way, 19 out of 41 days. And said in a press release, Olbermann didn't meet the basic standards of civility and professionalism. They also made clear they plan to keep the $40 million left on his five-year $50 million contract. Olbermann, on the other hand, said that Current couldn't even keep the lights on. The power failed during one of his broadcasts, and said that if it was all the same to them, he'd prefer to actually get paid that $40 million, if you don't mind. Meanwhile, Olbermann's replacement, Elliot Spitzer, debuted to a less than minuscule audience of 47,000 viewers, about a third of Olbermann's final ratings, and Reuters is reporting that Time Warner Cable might have the ability to dump the channel entirely if it doesn't meet certain ratings thresholds. So Current's in a bit of a logjam here. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. They're suing each other. Who cares? I imagine he's probably got a good case. He's always been a difficult employee to deal with. They knew that when they hired him. I'm sure he met his contractual obligations. In fact, his lawyer has already released things like, you know, here's the email where they went back and forth about what day he could have off and have not. Clearly nothing was done, you know, on a whim or haphazardly. He clearly, you know, took care to always, you know, go through proper channels. As far as we can tell, it looks like, you know, not, you know, they've got a good paper trail for everything they did. So they're going to have a hard case to make that he was just completely untenable. And, you know, just like Charlie Sheen, they're going to settle long before they get to court, and he's going to get much of his money.
Yes, I would imagine he would. Now, he was also on 2 days later after this whole thing blew up. He was on the Late Night with David Letterman show. And did you see that interview?
No, I didn't, actually.
He compared himself to a $10 million chandelier. He said, look, if you're going to go out and buy a $10 million chandelier, you should probably have a house to hang it in. Otherwise, it's going to be useless. And so if you have this $10 million chandelier and no house, you know, it's kind of useless. And Letterman turned to him after a pause and said, you're the chandelier?
Okay.
And, you know, Letterman still has that perfect timing.
Yeah.
Now, here's another example of the funhouse atmosphere of the web where old stories become new again. Back in January, we told you that Avatar 2 was going to be delayed until at least December of 2015, according to producer Jon Landau. That was what he told reporters after a screening of some footage of the 3D Titanic film in London. It was picked up by New York Magazine at the time, and the info bounced around the web. That wasn't much of a shocker since the film had already been pushed back from a very tentative 2013 to 2014, and now at least the end of 2015. Still, since Avatar is the hottest, highest grossing film of all time, it was news. But is it still news? That is the question, Michael. Apparently, not a lot of people were paying attention back in January. Don't they all listen to Showbiz Sandbox, for Pete's sake? Anyway, producer Jon Landau repeated this little tidbit to the UK movie magazine Empire, and they got it on video. On video, I tell you! Oh well, video makes it really news, I suppose, and the delay of Avatar became a headline again thanks to the Huffington Post. Make that Huffington Post US, since the UK edition had headlined that story back in January, when it was, you know, newsworthy. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Woo! Well, that was a long way to get there, but I think it's a big deal that you got to pay attention to, you know, how people are reporting news. You know, it's just like, just because they're mentioning it now does not mean it's news or important or necessary. You know, is it important? You know, is it's on the front page? When did it first happen? I mean, this is lazy journalism where people are not paying attention. And in fact, Huffington Post UK, you know, had it up in January. So the idea that they would suddenly splash it on the front page of their entertainment section is just silly.
So, you know, it's a big whoop then.
It's a big whoop, but it's a big deal in showing how you have to really pay attention to, you know, news cycles and how webs are making news and, you know, how good a job they're doing. And this is an example of a bad job.
And so I guess Universal rebooting The Mummy, also a big whoop.
Rebooting The Mummy?
Yeah, they're going to go back in time. The guy that that wrote Prometheus, the prequel to Alien, is also writing a reboot of the Mummy franchise that starred Brendan Fraser for Universal.
They're doing The Mummy and Logan's Run and every other property they've ever done before will be done again, I guess. So that is a big whoop.
7 seasons in, and suddenly the CBS sitcom How I Met Your Mother is turning into a hit. Now, it's always been a solid performer, but it's very, very rare for a sitcom to hit a ratings high 7 years into its run. The legal drama Law & Order pulled a similar stunt thanks to constant reruns, goosing the show's popularity. In today's modern age, How I Met Your Mother is getting exposure in 2 areas. First, the channel FX has been stripping reruns, so every night of the week. The show has been in syndication, but those have much less visibility in this day and age of hundreds of channels and DVRs. But FX reaches a core of young viewers. Even more important, How I Met Your Mother's first seasons became available on Netflix, where people new to the show could easily gobble up entire seasons. Netflix as a boost for network TV? Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a very big deal. I think Netflix has been paying through the nose for getting the rights to show shows on their thing. Maybe networks should be encouraging them to highlight and focus some of their shows that they're trying to get traction on. Say, hey, could you promote and push the first 3 seasons of our new show? You know, that's something that they should keep in mind. You know, when people have that easy access to shows, and it's so much easier than even renting the DVDs and getting them sent in the mail. You can just go online and gobble them up really quickly. Hey, that's a great function, a great way. It's, you know, on-demand television that like HBO provides. If your show, you want it to be a big hit, you've had your season one, I would definitely want my season one hit like Once Upon a Time or Grimm or any other new show that I have to be on Netflix and available for people to watch right now so they can get pretty and primed up for season 2 when it launches.
Wait, get pretty?
Get pretty. That's right. Yeah, and you see the boost that shows get. Big Bang Theory also has been boosted up in the ratings a bit because its episodes have been on TBS. It used to be shows got pressed down a little bit. When a show became available in syndication, sometimes the ratings went down because suddenly it was everywhere and people felt like they were exhausted and they could see it all the time, every day. And that sort of depressed ratings. But then you saw Law & Order, that those reruns could help build a new audience for a show. And some sitcoms, now that syndication doesn't mean as much, there's so many channels and so many ways to see so many shows that it just doesn't have the same impact. So in fact, it helps the show. And when you get on one channel and you start to goose that channel and they have you on all the time, like 2 hours or an hour of Big Bang every day on TBS, that makes the show more popular because people suddenly are aware of it again. Like, oh, I should watch new episodes. I like that show.
Well, this next story could have been a story unto itself and not a big deal, big whoop. But, you know, we've tried to shy away from all of this News Corp scandal here. Now, of course, more fallout occurred last week from this phone hacking scandal in the UK. One-time heir apparent James Murdoch has resigned as the head of BSky B, though he remains on its board. Officially, he stepped down to avoid distracting from the company's work. In fact, he really stepped down ahead of yet another investigation revealing Murdoch was more deeply involved in the scandal than he initially admitted, revelations that would have led to serious calls for his dismissal anyway. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
In a way, I think it's a big whoop. I mean, you know, they just keep dancing around and avoiding huge penalties. They're sort of minimizing as much as possible the effect on their company. You know, they shut down one newspaper, and then 8 months later, they just expand another one of their newspapers, their most popular one, to Sunday. So, you know, they shut down their Sunday paper, but now they've replicated it. James Murdoch steps down from this empire, but in fact, he's still on the board.
So he'll just come back later.
Yeah, we want to see what the long-term fallout is. If he gets arrested and gets put into jail, where he has to actually literally leave the company and not come back, then we'll see a real repercussion to what's been going on there.
Now, Google is great at search. We all know that. Google is great at ads, as we talked about earlier in the show. But retail? Selling consumer stuff? Not so much. The latest flop is Google's arrangement with independent bookstores. Google made a deal in 2010 to provide ebook support for independent bookstores. They could sell their customers ebooks and collect a fee with Google, doing all the complicated backroom support for technology that had to work with a range of different devices and credit card companies. But Google provided no ad support and no initiative. Tiny indie bookstores didn't have the resources to trumpet the arrangement, and most customers still have absolutely no idea they can purchase ebooks from their favorite local bookstore. Now it's collapsed, with the deal dying by the end of the year and the American Booksellers Association determined to offer a better long-term partner for the indies. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a very big deal for independent bookstores. It's been huge news in Publishers Weekly and elsewhere. They're trying desperately to gain traction. They see customers going online to ebooks. They want to be part of the mix. They realize, you know, half of their business is going to be in ebooks. If they can't get a piece of that pie, these indie bookstores are going to die on the vine. And Google just spent 2 years jerking them around, not doing a very good job, and now walking away from it. And that's really set them back a lot in terms of trying to get a real solution to this long term. One thing they need to do is come up with an indie e-reader like the Nook and like the Kindle. They need their own e-reader that's a nice, good, strong, solid device that people can buy and make it as easy as possible for them to buy their e-books via their independent bookstore. If they don't do that, I don't think they're going
to
survive.
Well, Google is rumored to launch a 7-inch device to compete with the Amazon Kindle probably this summer. But don't you think these bookstores will just wind up with either IndieBound or Barnes & Noble or Amazon?
What do you mean Barnes & Noble?
Well, don't you think that Barnes & Noble may decide to supply? Well, maybe not, because they are competing. But if Barnes & Noble decides to supply the backroom offices for that kind of activity, could be interesting.
I don't see why they would. I mean, that's their competitor.
Yeah, that's true. Good point.
Well, I don't think Kindle is going to provide their back room either, you know. And if they do, they'll get such a small sliver of the profit that it's not going to help the indie stores anyway.
Yeah, but, you know, well, I mean, we could debate this for a while, but we should probably move on because we are running long here. ABC announced that the complete first season of 4 new TV shows would be available on DVD just weeks after their season finales. The 4 shows include the likely to be canceled The River, Missing, and probable returning shows Scandal and GCB, which stands for what again? Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. I've been pushing for this for years. In the UK, shows are available the second the season is over, if not even before the season begins, especially with like a miniseries and stuff. But America has much longer seasons with 20 episodes or 15 or 24 episodes in a season. And they always wait until the beginning of the new season, so like a day or two before the new season begins. They release the first season on DVD, meaning if you want to catch up and become a fan, you've got like 3 days to do it. It's stupid. And I think they should be doing this, piggybacking on the season finale, getting people go, oh, I missed the end of the season finale, or, oh, I've heard about that show, it got good reviews, oh, I want to check it out. Make it available as quickly as possible. ABC's finally doing it. I hope everybody else follows their example.
Now, it's a small step from inspiring profiles of American Idol hopefuls to inspiring profiles of American Olympic hopefuls. And Ryan Seacrest is taking that step. It was announced that the host of American Idol will join the NBC team covering the London Summer Olympics. Seacrest made the announcement on the Today Show, where he was interviewed by Matt Lauer, and they both joked about Seacrest gunning for Lauer's job. So now Seacrest hosts Idol, his daily radio show, the E! Channel, and is expanding his work at NBC while launching his own cable channel with Mark Cuban. Frankly, I think NBC just wanted him because he speaks perfect English and the Olympics are in the UK. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
What? it's a big whoop. It's a small little addition to his portfolio. Not surprisingly, a day or two later, Matt Lauer announced that he would re-sign with Today Show for a multi-year agreement. You know, the whole idea was that NBC said, oh, Matt, you're thinking you're trying to play hardball with us? You know, we got Ryan Seacrest right here. He's ready to take over the Today Show. We'd feel comfortable with that. And Matt Lauer said, no. Everybody's happy. He got a big amount of money. He's on the Today Show for several years to come, and everybody's happy.
Well, that moves us along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business, and more importantly, how they affect you. And indeed, this week's story, well, we're not going to spend too much time on it, but it does affect you, or should affect you, or might affect you. Who knows? Paramount is signing up with Google to rent movies through both Google Play, the Google Play Store, which is like a big Android store, as well as YouTube. And so they're going to give the studio's going to give 500 different titles to YouTube and Google.
Right. It seems like they're almost all the major studios have signed up now with Google, right?
I think all but one, so 5 of 6.
Right, just Fox is the only one that hasn't signed up yet. So they've got almost everybody on the dotted line, at least providing some programming, some content to Google Play and YouTube. YouTube is now an area where you can rent shows and rent movies and watch them bit by bit, kind of like Hulu and all these other services. And Google Play is, of course, their little world where you can watch movies, buy books, listen to music. They want you to just think of Google Play as where you go for your digital content. 500 titles is pretty low, frankly. I think I'm not sure how many Google has yet, but I mean, it's not a drop in the bucket compared to the hundreds of thousands of titles that Netflix has at its beck and command. But it's a step in the right direction.
Well, yeah, what's even more shocking is the same week that this is announced, Paramount is a Viacom company. Now, here's the thing. Viacom sued YouTube for copyright infringement, and that lawsuit was kind of thrown out or dismissed, and yet...
Well, they appealed it.
Yeah. Then they appealed it. Yeah, Viacom appealed it. And this was because, I guess back in, you know, between 2005 and 2008, YouTube had some content on it from Comedy Central's The Daily Show and The Colbert Report, and YouTube was saying, no, we had no idea that was there, and we're cleared because of Safe Harbor, which is the DMCA allows you to...
They removed content whenever it was brought to their attention.
Right, but...
So, I mean, people were posting clips from The Daily Show and lots of other shows, not just The Daily Show,
right,
on YouTube, and when Viacom spotted it, they would say, hey, YouTube, this is on your channel, then YouTube would remove it. But Viacom says, hey, it's part of your business model that people post pirated material. You know they're going to do it, and you may remove it when we let you know, but your whole plan is built around people using illegal material that they don't own the rights to build your audience and your website. So they're saying you're inherently allowing piracy. And that's what the lawsuit is about.
That's exactly right. Thank you for saving me there from stumbling over my own words. That's absolutely right. And the U.S. Second Circuit Court of Appeals actually remanded the case to a lower court, instructing the district judge to figure out whether YouTube had any knowledge or awareness of specific infringing material on its site and whether it willfully blinded itself to the specific content that was infringing. Because if that is the case, then YouTube would not be clear under the safe harbor. They would kind of forfeit their safe harbor. And there are several emails between YouTube executives and Google executives that clearly state that they knew this was going on.
Well, they knew it was going on in general, but I don't think it was part of their business plan. That's their argument, certainly, that, you know, they knew it was going on and they stopped it whenever they could, and they were willing to stop it again. But it's like saying you're responsible for people downloading music onto your home computer just because you're the cable company providing internet access. YouTube is saying, hey, we got tens of millions of people downloading stuff. We're not responsible for them doing individual bad action. We stop it whenever we find it out. It's not our business. You know what our business is? Here's a video of a cute kitten, and they'll show the tens of millions of hits that their kitty videos get, and they'll say, you know what, we got a lot of videos like this. They're adorable, adorable little kittens. And, you know, oh, the judge will go, oh, and they'll say, that's true. I've watched those too. That isn't just their business, isn't The Daily Show. They also show cute kitties.
And in fact, YouTube now has 1 hour of video uploaded every second of the day. That's absolutely stunning to me. That's a remarkable figure.
Right. So, and the funny thing about this is, on the one hand, Paramount is making a deal with Google and signing up stuff to them, and on the other hand, Paramount is suing Google because Google owns YouTube. So they're making a deal on the one hand and suing them on the other. That's called business.
Now, speaking of business, we're going to move along into listener email. We had a lot of email this week. We'll have to save some for next week. Our email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. We've chosen one this week from Eric Garfield of New York, New York, who appears to be an attorney, and he is writing to us about the Huffington Post story, Tassini versus AOL Inc., the kind of class action lawsuit from the bloggers who were looking for money after the Huffington Post sold to AOL for $300+ million. Now, Michael, I don't know how you want to handle this. This is a pretty long email.
Well, I haven't seen it yet, so why don't you tackle it, I guess.
Okay, that shouldn't be a problem here. He writes, to whom it may concern. I don't know who he thought he was, like, you know, our big, huge staff here was going to answer this letter.
That's right, one of our assistants.
Yes, our numerous assistants. If you can't see them, that's because we only hire invisible assistants. That's our rule. We also hire people to write our poor jokes, so they're not all mine. An acquaintance made me aware of a debate you had on one of your recent shows concerning the Tassini v. AOL Inc. class action lawsuit. As an attorney specializing in labor laws, he thought I could help resolve the dispute. Apparently he is an attorney. After listening to the show, I can say that you are both correct. The plaintiffs in Tassini v. AOL Inc. claimed that under New York General Business Law 349, the Huffington Post was unjustly enriched by their work, which was completed under a contract, quote-unquote, implied in law. The plaintiffs were really stretching the intention of 349, since the law was written to benefit consumers. Nevertheless, I love that, nevertheless, businesses and non-consumer parties can bring claims under 349 provided a defendant's quote-unquote alleged conduct have brought harm. In his decision, Southern District Judge John Coltle, how do you pronounce that, Cottle, wrote that the plaintiffs failed to quote-unquote show any harm to any consumer, end quote. This is all very technical, however, which is why Judge Cottle only cited 349 at the end of his decision. He instead focused on the purpose of unjust enrichment claims. In such cases, a plaintiff expects financial remuneration should a defendant benefit financially due to the plaintiff's work. That's a circular sentence if I've ever seen one. This is where Michael's point is correct. In Ticini v. AOL Inc., the plaintiffs never expected payment for the work they are doing under the implied contract. The key passages from Judge Cottle's decision countering the plaintiff's argument include, and this is a quote, "The plaintiffs entered into their transactions with the defendants with full knowledge of the facts and no expectations of compensation other than exposure. No one forced the plaintiffs to give their work to the Huffington Post for publication, and the plaintiffs candidly admit that they did not expect compensation. The principles of equity and good conscience do not justify giving the plaintiffs a piece of the purchase price when they never expected to be paid, repeatedly agreed to the same bargain, and went into the agreement with eyes wide open." I believe that is the same excerpt that we picked last week, Michael.
Okay.
Here the judge is addressing the plaintiff's initial understanding of financial remuneration, or lack thereof, under the implied contract. As Sperling correctly pointed out, Judge Cottle was also defining the compensation the plaintiffs were expecting, exposure. However, in an unjust enrichment claim, this could lead to an appeal for fiscal remuneration. That is why the judge underscored his decision by writing, and this is again a quote, "There is no question that the plaintiffs submitted their materials to the Huffington Post with no expectation of monetary compensation, and that they got what they paid for, exposure, in the Huffington Post. Courts applying New York law require a plaintiff to allege some expectation of compensation that was denied in order to demonstrate that equity requires restitution." Sperling raised the notion that Judge Cottle's use of the words, quote-unquote, monetary compensation, end quote, was meant to refute any argument surrounding compensation was correct. So that's what I was trying to explain, that when he used that word monetary, that's when he was really kind of saying, you got paid, your payment was exposure. As Sperling suggested, though without legal justification or explanation, love the way he writes that, the plaintiff's expectation of compensation was met through their exposure on the Huffington Post website. Hence, the expectation of compensation and its definition in the implied contract contradict the claim, as the defendants noted in their arguments. Labor law is often difficult to understand and never strictly black and white, yet Judge Cottle did a good job in his written decision to remove any shades of gray in Ticini v. AOL Inc. It would be foolish, though, to count Jonathan Ticini out. He was, after all, the lead plaintiff in the Supreme Court's landmark ruling on New York Times Co. v. Ticini in 2001, wherein it was decided that newspapers could not use the work of freelance journalists online if it had only been licensed for use in printed publications. The case was originally heard by District Court Judge Sonia Sotomayor, who ruled in favor of the Times. Ticini successfully appealed the case all the way to the Supreme Court, of which Sotomayor is now a justice. I hope the above helps explain further some of the legal proceedings in Ticini v. AOL Inc., and while I am not necessarily your target audience, I enjoyed the show in which the debate over the court ruling was discussed. Respectfully, Eric Garfield, New York, New York.
Well, Eric, thanks for letting us know that and breaking it down for us. Appreciate your taking the time to do that. The one thing I wonder is, he says, don't count Ticini out. I go, well, why not? He doesn't mention any grounding that Ticini might have for a viable appeal. In that other case, of course, I thought he did have a very strong case to make. I'm not sure what his strong case is here or what's been left open as far as a possibility. He certainly doesn't point anything out. As far as his description of the judge's ruling, it sounds very sound. And it sounds like, you know, he didn't succeed in any aspect. I'm not sure, you know, what he's got a leg to stand on for.
I'm not sure either. And as Eric Garfield points out,
We
have no idea what we're talking about. So I'm going to just back off of that.
I'm going to count Ticini out in this case because I don't see any grounds whatsoever. I don't see. I thought he had a good case in the other one, Versus the Times. I don't see it here. And I think Eric underlines that with his explanation of the judge's ruling, which I really appreciate.
Yes, likewise. And in fact, if you want to write to us, our email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call us and leave us a voicemail, which we can play on a future episode. Our phone number is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find those ways to contact us or ways to follow us on Facebook, where our username is showbizsandbox, or on Twitter, where our username is showbizsandbox. Go figure. All of this information can be found at showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael has his own website where most of his work appears. Michael, what is it?
I think it's michaelgiltz.com.
Very, very complicated, I know. Some of my writing appears on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.